After that, Jack concentrated on his paddling, firmly putting out of his mind any considerations of what he would do if Morgan's men had killed Speedy. He had to get under the pilings, and that was that. A bullet hit the water, causing a tiny eruption of droplets about 6 feet to his left. He heard another ricochet off the breakwater with a ping. Jack paddled forward with his whole strength. Some time, he knew not how long, went by. At last he rolled off the side of the raft and swam to the back so that he could push it even faster by scissoring his legs. An almost imperceptible current swept him nearer his goal. At last the pilings began, high, crusty columns of wood as thick around as telephone poles. Jack raised his chin out of the water and saw the immensity of the hotel lifting itself above the wide black deck, leaning out over him. He glanced back and to his right, but Speedy had not moved. Or had he? Speedy's arms looked different. Maybe there was a flurry of movement on the long, grassy descent behind the row of falling down houses. Jack looked up and saw four of the men in black suits racing down toward the beach. A wave slapped the raft, almost taking it from his grasp. Richard moaned. Two of the men pointed toward him. Their mouths moved. Another high wave rocked the raft and threatened to push both raft and Jack Sawyer back toward the beach. Wave? Jack thought. What wave? He looked up over the front of the raft as soon as it dipped again into a trough. The broad gray back of something surely too large to be a mere fish was sinking beneath the surface. A shark? Jack was uneasily conscious of his two legs fluttering out behind him in the water. He ducked his head under, afraid he'd see a long, cigar-shaped stomach with teeth sweeping toward him. He did not see that shape, not exactly, but what he saw astounded him. The water, which appeared now to be very deep, was as full as an aquarium, though one containing no fish of normal size or description. In this aquarium, only monsters swam. Beneath Jack's legs moved a zoo of outsized, sometimes horrendously ugly animals. They must have been beneath him and the raft ever since the water had grown deep enough to accommodate them, for the water was crowded everywhere. The thing that had frightened the renegade wolves glided by, 10 feet down, long as a southbound freight train. It moved upward as he watched. A film over its eyes blinked. Long whiskers trailed back from its cavernous mouth. It had a mouth like an elevator door, Jack thought. The creature glided past him, pushing Jack closer to the hotel with the weight of the water it displaced, and raised its dripping snout above the surface. Its furry profile resembled Neanderthal man's. "Old Bloat and his boy's gonna steer clear of the water," Speedy had told him, and laughed. Whatever force had sealed the talisman in the Black Hotel had set these creatures in the waters off Point Venuti to make sure that the wrong people kept away, and Speedy had known it. The great bodies of the creatures in the water delicately nudged the raft nearer and nearer the pilings, but the waves they made kept Jack from getting all but the most fragmentary view of what was happening on shore. He rode up a crest and saw Sunlight Gardner, his hair flowing out behind him, standing beside the black fence, leveling a long, heavy hunting rifle at his head. The raft sank into the trough. The shell sizzled past far overhead with the noise of a hummingbird's passing. The report came. When Gardner shot next, a fish-like thing, 10 feet long, with a great sail of a dorsal fin, rose straight up out of the water and stopped the bullet. In one motion, the creature rolled back down and sliced into the water again. Jack saw a great, ragged hole in its side. The next time he rode up a crest, Gardner was trotting off across the beach, clearly on his way to the Kingsland Motel. The giant fish continued to wash him diagonally forward toward the pilings. "A ladder," Speedy had said. And as soon as Jack was under the wide deck, he peered through the gloom to try to find it. The thick pilings, encrusted with algae and barnacles and dripping with seaweed, stood in four rows. If the ladder had been installed at the time the deck was built, it might easily be useless now. At the least, a wooden ladder would be hard to see, overgrown with weed and barnacles. The big, shaggy pilings were now much thicker than they had been originally. Jack got his forearms over the back of the raft and used the thick, rubbery tail to lever himself back inside. Then, shivering, he unbuttoned his sodden shirt, the same white button-down at least one size too small Richard had given him on the other side of the blasted lands, and dropped it squashily in the bottom of the raft. His shoes had fallen off in the water, and he peeled off the wet socks and tossed them on top of the shirt. Richard sat in the bow of the raft, slouching forward over his knees, his eyes shut and his mouth closed. "We're looking for a ladder," Jack said. Richard acknowledged this with a barely perceptible movement of his head. "Do you think you could get up a ladder, Richie?"
"Maybe," Richard whispered.
"Well, it's around here somewhere, probably attached to one of these pilings." Jack paddled with both hands, bringing the raft between two of the pilings in the first row. The talisman's call was continuous now, and seemed nearly strong enough to pick him up out of the raft and deposit him on the deck. They were drifting between the first and second rows of pilings, already under the heavy black line of the deck above. Here, as well as outside, little red flares ignited in the air, twisted, winked out. Jack counted. 4 rows of pilings, 5 pilings in each row. 20 places where the ladder might be. With the darkness beneath the deck and the endless refinements of corridors suggested by the pilings, being here was like taking a tour of the catacombs.
"They didn't shoot us," Richard said without affect.
In the same tone of voice, he might have said, "The store is out of bread." "We had some help." He looked at Richard, slumped over his knees. Richard would never be able to get up a ladder unless he were somehow galvanized. "We're coming up to a piling," Jack said. "Lean forward and shove us off, will you?"
"What?"
"Keep us from bumping into the piling," Jack repeated. "Come on, Richard, I need your help." It seemed to work. Richard cracked open his left eye and put his right hand on the edge of the raft. As they drifted nearer to the thick piling, he held out his left hand to deflect them. Then something on the pillar made a smacking sound, as of lips pulled wetly apart. Richard grunted and retracted his hand.
"What was it?"
Jack said. And Richard did not have to answer. Now both boys saw the slug-like creatures clinging to the pilings. Their eyes had been closed, too, and their mouths. Agitated, they began to shift positions on their pillars, clattering their teeth. Jack put his hands in the water and swung the bow of the raft around the piling.
"Oh, God!"
Richard said. Those lipless, tiny mouths held a quantity of teeth.
"God! I can't take
you." "You have to take it, Richard," Jack said. "Didn't you hear Speedy back there on the beach? He might even be dead now, Richard, and if he is, he died so he could be certain that I knew you had to go in the hotel." Richard had closed his eyes again. "And I don't care how many slugs we have to kill to get up the ladder, you are going up the ladder, Richard. That's all. That's it."
"Shit on you," Richard said. "You don't have to talk to me like that. I'm sick of you being so high and mighty. I know I'm going up the ladder, wherever it is. I probably have a fever of 105, but I know I'm going up that ladder. I just don't know if I can take it, so to hell with you."
Richard had uttered this entire speech with his eyes shut. He effortfully forced both eyes open again.
"Nuts!"
"I need you," Jack said.
"Nuts! I'll get up the ladder, you asshole."
"In that case, I'd better find it," Jack said, pushed the raft forward toward the next row of pilings, and saw it. The ladder hung straight down between the 2 inner rows of pilings, ending some 4 feet above the surface of the water. A dim rectangle at the top of the ladder indicated that a trap door opened onto the deck. In the darkness, it was only the ghost of a ladder, half visible. "We're in business, Richie," Jack said. He guided the raft carefully past the next piling, making sure not to scrape against it. The hundreds of slug-like creatures clinging to the piling bared their teeth. In seconds, the horse's head at the front of the raft was gliding beneath the bottom of the ladder, and then Jack could reach up to grab the bottom rung.
"Okay," he said.
First, he tied one sleeve of his sodden shirt around the rung, the other around the stiff, rubbery tail next to him. At least the raft would still be there, if they ever got out of the hotel. Jack's mouth abruptly dried. The talisman sang out, calling to him. He stood up carefully in the raft and hung on to the ladder. "You first," he said. "It's not going to be easy, but I'll help you."
"Don't need your help," Richard said.
Standing up, he nearly pitched forward and threw both of them out of the raft.
"Easy now. Don't easy me."
Richard extended both arms and steadied himself. His mouth was pinched. He looked afraid to breathe. He stepped forward.
"Good. Asshole."
Richard moved his left foot forward, raised his right arm, brought his right foot forward. Now he could find the bottom of the ladder with his hands as he fiercely squinted through his right eye.
"See?"
"Okay," Jack said, holding both hands palm out before him, fingers extended, indicating that he would not insult Richard with the offer of physical aid. Richard pulled on the ladder with his hands, and his feet slid irresistibly forward, pushing the raft with them. In a second, he was suspended half over the water. Only Jack's shirt kept the raft from zooming out from under Richard's feet.
"Help!
Pull your feet back." Richard did so and stood upright again, breathing hard. "Let me give you a hand, okay?"
"Okay."
Jack crawled along the raft until he was immediately before Richard. He stood up with great care. Richard gripped the bottom rung with both hands, trembling. Jack put his hands on Richard's skinny hips.
"I'm going to help lift you. Try not to kick out with your feet. Just pull yourself up high enough to get your knee on the rung. First, put your hands up on the next one."
Richard cracked open an eye and did so.
"You ready? Go."
The raft slid forward, but Jack yanked Richard upright so high that he could easily place his right knee on the bottom rung. Then Jack grabbed the sides of the ladder and used the strength in his arms and legs to stabilize the raft. Richard was grunting, trying to get his other knee on the rung. In a second, he had done it. In another 2 seconds, Richard Sloat stood upright on the ladder.
"I can't go any farther," he said. "I think I'm going to fall off. I feel so sick, Jack."
"Just go up one more, please, please, then I can help you." Richard wearily moved his hands up a rung. Jack, looking toward the deck, saw that the ladder must be 30 feet long.
"Now move your feet, please, Richard."
Richard slowly placed one foot, then the next, on the second rung. Jack placed his hands on the outsides of Richard's feet and pulled himself up. The raft swung out in a looping half-circle, but he raised his knees and got both legs securely on the lowest rung. Held by Jack's outstretched shirt, the raft swung back around like a dog on a leash. A third of the way up the ladder, Jack had to put one arm around Richard's waist to keep him from falling into the black water. At last, the rectangular square of the trap door floated in the black wood directly above Jack's head. He clamped Richard to himself. His unconscious head fell against Jack's chest. By reaching around both Richard and ladder with his left hand, and tried the trapdoor with his right. Suppose it had been nailed shut. But it swung up immediately and banged flat against the top of the deck. Jack got his left arm firmly under Richard's armpits and hauled him up out of the blackness and through the hole in the deck. Interlude. Sloat in this world. 5. The Kingsland Motel had been empty for nearly 6 years, and it had the moldy, yellow newspaper smell of buildings that have been deserted for a long time. This smell had disturbed Sloat at first. His maternal grandmother had died at home when Sloat was a boy. It had taken her 4 years, but she had finally made the grade, and the smell of her dying had been like this. He did not want such a smell or such memories at a moment which was supposed to be his greatest triumph. Now, however, it didn't matter. Not even the infuriating losses inflicted on him by Jack's early arrival at Camp Readiness mattered. His earlier feelings of dismay and fury had turned into a frenzy of nervous excitement. Head down, lips twitching, eyes bright, he strode back and forth through the room where he and Richard had stayed in the old days. Sometimes he locked his hands behind his back, sometimes he slammed one fist into the other palm, sometimes he stroked his bald pate. Mostly, however, he paced, as he had in college, with his hands clenched into tight and somehow anal little fists, the hidden nails digging viciously into his palms. His stomach was by turns sour and giddily light. Things were coming to a head. No, no. Right idea, wrong phrase. Things were coming together. Richard is dead by now. My son is dead. Got to be. He survived the blasted lands, barely, but he'll never survive the Agincourt. He's dead. Hold out no false hope for yourself on that score. Jack Sawyer killed him, and I'll gouge the eyes out of his living head for it. But I killed him too, Morgan whispered, stopping for a moment. Suddenly he thought of his father. Gordon Sloat had been a dour Lutheran minister in Ohio. Morgan had spent his whole boyhood trying to flee that harsh and frightening man. Finally, he had escaped to Yale. He had set his entire mind and spirit on Yale in his sophomore year of high school, for one reason above all others, unadmitted by his conscious mind, but as deep as bedrock. It was a place where his rude, rural father would never dare to come. If his father ever tried to set foot on the Yale campus, something would happen to him. Just what that something might be, the high school-age Sloat was not sure. But it would be roughly akin, he felt, to what had happened to the Wicked Witch when Dorothy threw the bucket of water over her. And this insight seemed to have been true. His father never had set foot on the Yale campus. From Morgan's first day there, Gordon Sloat's power over his son had begun to wane. That alone made all the striving and effort seem worthwhile. But now, as he stood with his fists clenched and his nails digging into his soft palms, his father spoke up. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world if he should lose his own son? For a moment that wet, yellow smell, the empty motel smell, the grandmother smell, the death smell, filled his nostrils, seeming to choke him, and Morgan Sloat Morgan of Oris was afraid. What does it profit a man, for it says in the Book of Good Farming, that a man shall not bring the get of his seed to any place of sacrifice? For what does it profit that man shall be damned and damned and damned, a man to gain the whole world if he should lose his own son? Stinking plaster, the dry smell of vintage mouse turds turning to powder in the dark spaces behind the walls— crazies, there were crazies in the streets. What does it profit a man? Dead. One son dead in that world, one son dead in this. What does it profit a man? Your son is dead, Morgan. Must be dead in the water, or dead under the pilings and floating around under there, or dead for sure, topside. Couldn't take it. Couldn't, what does it profit? And suddenly the answer came to him. "It profits a man the world!" Morgan shouted in the decaying room. He began to laugh and pace again. "It profits a man the world! And by Jason, the world is enough!" Laughing, he began to pace faster and faster, and before long blood had begun to drip out of his clenched fists. A car pulled up out front about 10 minutes later. Morgan went to the window and saw Sunlight Gardner come bursting out of the Cadillac. Seconds later, he was hammering on the door with both fists, like a tantrumy 3-year-old hammering on the floor. Morgan saw that the man had gone utterly crazy, and wondered if this was good or bad. "Morgan!" Gardner bellowed. "Open for me, my lord! News! I have news!" "I saw all your news through my binoculars, I think. Hammer on that door a while longer, Gardner, while I make up my mind on this. Is it good that you should be crazy, or is it bad?" "Good," Morgan decided. In Indiana, Gardner had turned sunlight yellow at the crucial moment and had fled without taking care of Jack once and for all. But now his wild grief had made him trustworthy again. If Morgan needed a kamikaze pilot, Sunlight Gardner would be the first one to the plains. "Open for me, my lord! News! News!" Morgan opened the door. Although he himself was wildly excited, the face he presented to Gardner was almost eerily serene.
"Easy," he said. "Easy, guard. You'll pop a blood vessel."
"They've gone to the hotel. The beach. Shot at them while they were on the beach. Stupid assholes missed. In the water, I thought. We'll get them in the water. Then the deep creatures rose up. I had them in my sights. I had that bad, bad boy right in my sights. And then the creatures, they...
"Slow down," Morgan said soothingly. He closed the door and took a flask out of his inside pocket. He handed it to Gardner, who spun the cap off and took two huge gulps. Morgan waited. His face was benign, serene, but a vein pulsed in the center of his forehead, and his hands opened and closed. Gone to the hotel, yes. Morgan had seen the ridiculous raft with its painted horse's head and its rubber tail bobbing its way out there. "My son," he said to Gardner. "Do your men say he was alive or dead when Jack put him in the raft?" Gardner shook his head, but his eyes said what he believed.
"No one knows for sure, my lord. Some say they saw him move, some say not."
"Doesn't matter. If he wasn't dead then, he's dead now. One breath of the air in that place and his lungs will explode."
Gardner's cheeks were full of whiskey color, and his eyes were watering. He didn't give the flask back, but stood holding it. That was fine with Sloat. He wanted neither whiskey nor cocaine. He was on what those 60s slobs had called a natural high.
"Start over," Morgan said, "and this time be coherent."
The only thing Gardner had to tell that Morgan hadn't gleaned from the man's first broken outburst was the fact of the old nigger's presence down on the beach, and he almost could have guessed that. Still, he let Gardner go on. Gardner's voice was soothing, his rage invigorating. As Gardner talked, Morgan ran over his options one final time, dismissing his son from the equation with a brief throb of regret. "What does it profit a man? It profits a man the world, and the world is enough. Or in this case, worlds, two to start with, and more when and if they play out. I can rule them all if I like. I can be something like the god of the universe. The talisman is... the key? No. Oh, no. Not a key, but a door. A locked door standing between him and his destiny. He did not want to open that door, but to destroy it. Destroy it utterly and completely and eternally, so it could never be shut again, let alone locked. When the talisman was smashed, all those worlds would be his worlds. "Guard," he said, and began to pace jerkily again. Gardner looked at Morgan questioningly.
"What does it profit a man?"
Morgan chirruped brightly.
"My lord, I don't underst—"
Morgan stopped in front of Gardner, his eyes feverish and sparkling. His face rippled, became the face of Morgan of Oris, became the face of Morgan Sloat again.
"It profits a man the world," Morgan said, putting his hands on Osmond's shoulders.
When he took them away a second later, Osmond was Gardner again.
"It profits a man the world, and the world is enough."
"My lord, you don't understand," Gardner said, looking at Morgan as if he might be crazy. "I think they've gone inside. Inside, where it is. We tried to shoot them, but the creatures, the deep creatures, rose up and protected them, just as the Book of Good Farming said they would. And if they're inside—"
Gardner's voice was rising. Osmond's eyes rolled with mingled hate and dismay.
"I understand," Morgan said comfortingly.
His face and voice were calm again, but his fists worked and worked, and blood dribbled down onto the mildewy carpet.
"Yes, siree, Bob. Yes, indeedy do, Rudy Patootie. They've gone in, and my son is never going to come out. You've lost yours, guard, and now I've lost mine."
"Sawyer!" Gardner barked. "Jack Sawyer! Jason!"
That Gardner lapsed into a horrible bout of cursing that went on for nearly 5 minutes. He cursed Jack in two languages, his voice racketed and perspired with grief and insane rage. Morgan stood there and let him get it all out of his system. When Gardner paused, panting, and took another swallow from the flask, Morgan said, "Right, doubled in brass. Now listen, Guard. Are you listening?"
"Yes, my lord."
Gardner Osmond's eyes were bright with bitter attention. "My son is never going to come out of the Black Hotel, and I don't think Sawyer ever will either. There's a very good chance that he isn't Jason enough yet to deal with what's in there. It will probably kill him, or drive him mad, or send him 100 worlds away. But he may come out, Guard. Yes, he may.
He's the baddest, baddest bitch's bastard to ever draw breath," Gardner whispered.
His hand tightened on the flask, tightened, tightened, and now his fingers actually began to make dents in the shell steel.
"You say the old nigger man is down on the beach?"
"Yes."
"Parker," Morgan said, and at the same moment Osmond said, "Parkus."
"Dead?" Morgan asked this without much interest.
"I don't know. I think so. Shall I send men down to pick him up?"
"No," Morgan said sharply, "no. But we're going down near where he is, aren't we, Guard?"
"We are."
Morgan began to grin.
"Yes. You, me, all of us. Because if Jack comes out of the hotel, he'll go there first. He won't leave his old night-fighting buddy on the beach, will he?"
Now Gardner also began to grin.
"No," he said, "no."
For the first time, Morgan became aware of dull and throbbing pain in his hands. He opened them and looked thoughtfully at the blood which flowed out of the deep semicircular wounds in his palms. His grin did not falter. Indeed, it widened. Gardner was staring at him solemnly. A great sense of power filled Morgan. He reached up to his neck and closed one bloody hand over the key that brought the lightning.
"It profits a man the world," he whispered. "Can you gimme hallelujah?"
His lips pulled even farther back. He grinned the sick yellow grin of a rogue wolf, a wolf that is old but still sly and tenacious and powerful.
"Come on, Guard," he said. "Let's go to the beach."
Chapter 41. The Black Hotel. Richard Sloat wasn't dead, but when Jack picked his old friend up in his arms, he was unconscious.
"Who's the herd now?" Wolf asked in his head. "Be careful, Jackie, Wolf."
"Be come to me, come now," the talisman sang in its powerful, soundless voice. "Come to me, bring the herd, and all will be well, and all will be well, and amen, and things will be well," Jack croaked. He started forward and came within an inch of stepping right back through the trapdoor, like a kid participating in some bizarre double execution by hanging. "Swing with a friend," Jack thought crazily. His heart was hammering in his ears, and for a moment he thought he might vomit straight down into the gray water slapping at the pilings. Then he caught hold of himself and closed the trapdoor with his foot. Now there was only the sound of the weather vanes, cabalistic brass designs spinning restlessly in the sky. Jack turned toward the Agincourt. He was on a wide deck, like an elevated veranda, he saw. Once fashionable 20s and 30s folk had sat out here at the cocktail hour under the shade of umbrellas, drinking gin rickeys and sidecars, perhaps reading the latest Edgar Wallace or Ellery Queen novel, perhaps only looking out toward where Las Cavernas Island could be dimly glimpsed, a blue-gray whale's hump dreaming on the horizon, the men in whites, the women in pastels. Once, maybe. Now the boards were warped and twisted and splintered. Jack didn't know what color the deck had been painted before, but now it had gone black, like the rest of the hotel. The color of this place was the color he imagined the malignant tumors in his mother's lungs must be. 20 feet away were Speedy's window doors, through which guests would have passed back and forth in those dim old days. They had been soaped over in wide white strokes,
so that they looked like blind eyes. Written on one was, "Your last chance to go home." Sound of the waves, sound of the twirling ironmongery on the angled roofs, stink of sea salt and old spilled drinks, drinks spilled long ago by beautiful people who are now wrinkled and dead, stink of the hotel itself. He looked at the soaped window again and saw with no real surprise that the message had already changed. "She's already dead, Jack, so why bother? Now who's the herd?" "You are, Richie," Jack said. "But you ain't alone." Richard made a snoring, protesting sound in Jack's arms. "Come on," Jack said, and began to walk. "One more mile, give or take." The soaked-over windows actually seemed to widen as Jack walked toward the Agincourt, as if the Black Hotel were now regarding him with blind but contemptuous surprise. "Do you really think, little boy, that you can come in here and really hope to ever come out? Do you think there's really that much Jason in you?" Red sparks, like those he had seen in the air, flashed and twisted across the soaped glass. For a moment they took form. Jack watched, wondering, as they became tiny fire imps. They skated down to the brass handles of the doors and converged there. The handles began to glow dully like a smith's iron in the forge. "Go on, little boy, touch one. Try." Once, as a kid of six, Jack had put his finger on the cold coil of an electric range and had then turned the control knob onto the high setting. He had simply been curious about how fast the burner would heat up. A second later, he had pulled his finger, already blistering, away with a yell of pain. Phil Sawyer had come running, taken a look, and had asked Jack when he had started to feel this weird compulsion to burn himself alive. Jack stood, with Richard in his arms, looking at the dully glowing handles. "Go on, little boy. Remember how the stove burned? You thought you'd have plenty of time to pull your finger off. Hell, you thought, the thing doesn't even start to get red for almost a minute. But it burned right away, didn't it? Now how do you think this is going to feel, Jack?" More red sparks skated liquidly down the glass to the handles of the French doors. The handles began to take on the delicate red edged with white look of metal, which is no more than 6 degrees from turning molten and starting to drip. If he touched one of those handles, it would sink into his flesh, charring tissue and boiling blood. The agony would be like nothing he had ever felt before. He waited for a moment with Richard in his arms, hoping the talisman would call him again, or that the Jason side of him would surface. But it was his mother's voice that rasped in his head. "Has something or someone always got to push you, Jacko? Come on, big guy, you set this going by yourself. You can keep going if you really want to. Has that other guy got to do everything for you?" "Okay, Mom," Jack said. He was smiling a little, but his voice was trembling with fright. "Here's one for you. I just hope someone remembered to pack the solar cane." He reached out and grasped one of the red-hot handles. Except it wasn't. The whole thing had been an illusion. The handle was warm, but that was all. As Jack turned it, the red glow died from all the handles. And as he pushed the glass door inward, the talisman sang out again, bringing goose flesh out all over his body. "Well done, Jason. To me, come to me." With Richard in his arms, Jack stepped into the dining room of the Black Hotel. As he crossed the threshold, he felt an inanimate force, something like a dead hand, try to shove him back out. Jack pushed against it, and a second or two later that feeling of being repelled ceased. The room was not particularly dark, but the soaked windows gave it a monochrome whiteness Jack did not like. He felt fogged in, blind. Here were yellow smells of decay inside walls where the plaster was slowly turning to a vile soup, the smells of empty age and sour darkness. But there was more here, and Jack knew it and feared it. Because this place was not empty. Exactly what manner of things might be here he did not know, but he knew that Sloat had never dared to come in, and he guessed that no one else would either. The air was heavy and unpleasant in his lungs, as if filled with a slow poison. He felt the strange levels and canted passageways and secret rooms and dead ends above him pressing down like the walls of a great and complex crypt. There was madness here and walking death and gibbering irrationality. Jack might not have had the words to express these things, but he felt them all the same. He knew them for what they were, just as he knew that all the talismans in the cosmos could not protect him from those things. He had entered a strange, dancing ritual whose conclusion, he felt, was not at all preordained. He was on his own. Something tickled against the back of his neck. Jack swept his hand at it and skittered to one side. Richard moaned thickly in his arms. It was a large black spider hanging on a thread. Jack looked up and saw its web in one of the stilled overhead fans, tangled in a dirty snarl between the hardwood blades. The spider's body was bloated. Jack could see its eyes. He couldn't remember ever having seen a spider's eyes before. Jack began to edge around the hanging spider toward the tables. The spider turned at the end of its thread, following him.
"Fushing thief!"
it suddenly squealed at him. Jack screamed and clutched Richard against him with panicky, galvanic force. His scream echoed across the high-ceilinged dining room. Somewhere in the shadows beyond there was a hollow metallic clank, and something laughed.
"Fushing thief! Fushing thief!"
the spider squealed, and then suddenly it scuttled back up into its web below the scrolled tin ceiling. Heart thumping, Jack crossed the dining room and put Richard on one of the tables. The boy moaned again, very faintly. Jack could feel the twisted bumps under Richard's clothes. "Gotta leave you for a little while, buddy," Jack said. From the shadows high above,
"I'll take good care of you, fushing thief!"
There was a dark, buzzing little giggle. There was a pile of linen underneath the table where Jack had laid Richard down. The top two or three tablecloths were slimy with mildew, but halfway through the pile he found one that wasn't too bad. He spread it out and covered Richard with it to the neck. He started away. The voice of the spider whispered thinly down from the angle of the fan blades, down from a darkness that stank of decaying flies and silk-wrapped wasps.
"I'll take care of him, you fushing thief!"
Jack looked up. Cold, but he couldn't see the spider. He could imagine those cold little eyes, but imagination was all it was. A tormenting, sickening picture came to him, that spider scuttling onto Richard's face, burrowing its way between Richard's slack lips and into Richard's mouth, crooning all the while,
"Fushing thief, fushing thief, fushing thief!"
He thought of pulling the tablecloth up over Richard's mouth as well, and discovered he could not bring himself to turn Richard into something that would look so much like a corpse. It was almost like an invitation. He went back to Richard and stood there, indecisive, knowing that his very indecision must make whatever forces there were here very happy indeed. Anything to keep him away from the talisman. He reached into his pocket and came out with the large, dark green marble. The magic mirror in the other world. Jack had no reason to believe it contained any special power against evil forces, but it came from the territories, and blasted lands aside, the territories were innately good. And innate goodness, Jack reasoned, must have its own power over evil. He folded the marble into Richard's hand. Richard's hand closed, then fell slowly open again as soon as Jack removed his own hand. From somewhere overhead, the spider chuffed dirty laughter. Jack bent low over Richard, trying to ignore the smell of disease, so like the smell of this place, and murmured, "Hold it in your hand, Richie. Hold it tight, chum."
"Don't, chum,"
Richard muttered, but his hand closed weakly on the marble.
"Thanks, Richie boy," Jack said. He kissed Richard's cheek gently, and then started across the dining room toward the closed double doors at the far end.
"It's like the Alhambra," he thought. "Dining room giving on the gardens there, dining room giving on a deck over the water here. Double doors in both places, opening on the rest of the hotel." As he crossed the room, he felt that dead hand pushing against him again. It was the hotel repelling him, trying to push him back out.
"Forget it," Jack thought, and kept going. The force seemed to fade almost at once.
"We have other ways," the double doors whispered as he approached them. Again Jack heard the dim, hollow clank of metal.
"You're worried about Sloat," the double doors whispered. Only now it wasn't just them. Now the voice Jack was hearing was the voice of the entire hotel.
"You're worried about Sloat and bad wolves and things that look like goats and basketball coaches who aren't really basketball coaches. You're worried about guns and plastic explosive and magic keys."
"We in here don't worry about any of those things, little one. They are nothing to us. Morgan Sloat is no more than a scurrying ant. He has only 20 years to live, and that is less than the space between breaths to us. We in the Black Hotel care only for the talisman, the nexus of all possible worlds. You've come as a burglar to rob us of what is ours, and we tell you once more, we have other ways of dealing with fushing thieves like you, and if you persist, you'll find out what they are. You'll find out for yourself."
Jack pushed open first one of the double doors, then the other. The casters squealed unpleasantly as they rolled along their recessed tracks for the first time in years. Beyond the doors was a dark hallway.
"That'll go to the lobby," Jack thought. "And then, if this place really is the same as the Alhambra, I'll have to go up the main staircase, one flight."
On the second floor he would find the grand ballroom, and in the grand ballroom he would find the thing he had come for. Jack took one look back, saw that Richard hadn't moved, and stepped into the hallway. He closed the doors behind him. He began to move slowly along the corridor, his frayed and dirty sneakers whispering over the rotting carpet. A little farther down, Jack could see another set of double doors with birds painted on them. Closer by were a number of meeting rooms. Here was the Golden State Room, directly opposite the 49er Room. 5 paces farther up toward the double doors with the painted birds was the Mendocino Room, hacked into a lower panel of the mahogany door, "Your mother died screaming." Far down the corridor, impossibly far, was watery light. The lobby. Clank. Jack wheeled around fast and caught a glimmer of movement just beyond one of the peaked doorways in the stone throat of this corridor.
Stones? Peaked doorways?
Jack blinked uneasily. The corridor was lined with dark mahogany paneling, which had now begun to rot in the oceanside damp. No stone. And the doors, giving on the Golden State Room and the 49er Room and the Mendocino Room, were just doors, sensibly rectangular and with no peaks. Yet for one moment he had seemed to see openings like modified cathedral arches. Filling these openings had been iron drop gates, the sort that could be raised or lowered by turning a windlass. Drop gates with hungry-looking iron spikes at the bottom. When the gate was lowered to block the entrance, the spikes fitted neatly into holes in the floor.
"No stone archways, Jacko. See for yourself. Just doorways. You saw drop gates like that in the Tower of London on the tour you went on with Mom and Uncle Tommy 3 years ago. You're just freaking a little, that's all."
But the feeling in the pit of his stomach was unmistakable. They were there, all right. I flipped. For just a second, I was in the territories. Clank. Jack whirled back the other way, sweat breaking out on his cheeks and forehead, hair beginning to stiffen on the nape of his neck. He saw it again, a flash of something metallic in the shadows of one of those rooms. He saw huge stones as black as sin, their rough surfaces splotched with green moss. Nasty, soft-looking albino bugs squirmed in and out of the large pores of the decaying mortar between the stones. Empty sconces stood at 15 or 20-foot intervals. The torches that the sconces had once held were long since gone. Clank! This time he didn't even blink. The world side-slipped before his eyes, wavering like an object seen through clear running water. The walls were blackish mahogany again, instead of stone blocks. The doors were doors, and not latticed iron drop gates. The two worlds, which had been separated by a membrane as thin as a lady's silk stocking, had now actually begun to overlap. And Jack realized dimly his Jason side had begun to overlap with his Jack side. Some third being, which was an amalgamation of both, was emerging. I don't know what that combination is exactly, but I hope it's strong, because there are things behind those doors, behind all of them. Jack began to sidle up the hallway again toward the lobby. Clank! This time the worlds didn't change. Solid doors remained solid doors, and he saw no movement. Right behind there, though. Right behind... Now he heard something behind the painted double doors. Written in the sky above the marsh scene were the words Heron Bar. It was the sound of some large, rusty machine that had been set in motion. Jack swung toward, Jason swung toward that opening door, that rising drop gate, his hand plunging into the poke, the pocket he wore on the belt of his jerkin, of his jeans, and closing around the guitar pick Speedy had given him so long ago, and closing around the shark's tooth. He waited to see what would come out of the Heron Bar, and the walls of the hotel whispered dimly, "We have ways of dealing with fushing thieves like you. You should have left while there was still time, because now, little boy, your time is up." Clank, thud. Clank, thud. Clank, thud. The noise was large and clumsy and metallic. There was something relentless and inhuman about it, which frightened Jack more badly than a more human sound would have done. It moved and shuffled its way forward with its own slow, idiot rhythm. Clank, thud. Clank, thud. There was a long pause. Jack waited, pressed against the far wall a few feet to the right of the painted doors, his nerves so tightly wound they seemed to hum. Nothing at all happened for a long time. Jack began to hope the clanker had fallen back through some interdimensional trapdoor and into the world it had come from. He became aware that his back ached from his artificially still and tautly erect posture. He slumped. Then there was a splintering crash, and a huge, mailed fist, with blunt 2-inch spikes sprouting from the knuckles, slammed through the peeling blue sky on the door. Jack shrank back against the wall again, gaping. And, helplessly, flipped into the territories. Standing on the other side of the drop gate was a figure in blackish, rusty armor. Its cylindrical helmet was broken only by a black horizontal eye slit no more than an inch wide. The helmet was topped by a frowsy red plume. White bugs squirmed in and out of it. They were the same sort, Jason saw, as those which had come out of the walls first in Albert the Blob's room and then all over Thayer School. The helmet ended in a coif of mail which draped the rusty knight's shoulders like a lady's stole. The upper arms and forearms were plated with heavy steel brassards. They were joined at the elbows with cubitières. These were crusted with layers of ancient filth, and when the knight moved, the cubitières squealed like the high, demanding voices of unpleasant children. Its armored fists were crazy with spikes. Jason stood against the stone wall, looking at it, unable, in fact, to look away. His mouth was dry as fever, and his eyeballs seemed to be swelling rhythmically in their sockets in time to his heartbeat. In the knight's right hand was Le Martel de Fer, a battle hammer with a rusty 30-pound forged steel head, as mute as murder. The drop gate. Remember that the drop gate is between you and it. But then, although no human hand was near it, the windlass began to turn. The iron chain, each link as long as Jack's forearm, began to wind around the drum, and the gate began to rise. The mailed fist was withdrawn from the door, leaving a splintered hole that changed the mural at once from faded pastoral romantic to surrealist bar sinister. It now looked as if some apocalyptic hunter, disappointed by his day in the marshes, had put a load of birdshot through the sky itself in a fit of pique. Then the head of the battle hammer exploded through the door in a huge, blunt swipe, obliterating one of the two herons struggling to achieve liftoff. Jack raised his hand in front of his face to protect it from splinters. The Martel de Fer was withdrawn. There was another brief pause, almost long enough for Jack to think about running again. Then the spiked fist tore through again. It twisted first one way and then the other, widening the hole, then withdrew. A second later, the hammer slammed through the middle of a reed bed, and a large chunk of the right-hand door fell to the carpet. Jack could now see the hulking, armored figure in the shadows of the heron bar. The armor was not the same as that worn by the figure confronting Jason in the Black Castle. That one wore a helmet which was nearly cylindrical with a red plume. This one wore a helmet that looked like the polished head of a steel bird. Horns rose from either side, sprouting from the helmet at roughly ear level. Jack saw a breastplate, a kilt of plate mail, a hemming of chainmail below that. The hammer was the same in both worlds, and in both worlds the knight twinners dropped in at the same instant, as if in contempt. Who would need a battle hammer to deal with such a puny opponent as this?
"Run, Jack, run!"
"That's right," the hotel whispered. "Run! That's what flushing thieves are supposed to do. Run! Run!" But he would not run. He might die, but he would not run, because that sly, whispering voice was right. Running was exactly what flushing thieves did. "But I'm no thief," Jack thought grimly. "That thing may kill me, but I won't run, because I'm no thief."
"I won't run!" Jack shouted at the blank, polished steel bird face. "I'm no thief, do you hear me? I've come for what's mine, and I'm no thief."
A groaning scream came from the breathing holes at the bottom of the bird helmet. The knight raised its spiked fists and brought them down, one on the sagging left door, one on the sagging right. The pastoral marsh world painted there was destroyed. The hinges snapped, and as the doors fell toward him, Jack actually saw the one painted heron who remained go flying away like a bird in a Walt Disney cartoon, its eyes bright and terrified. The suit of armor came toward him like a killer robot, its feet rising and then crashing down. It was more than 7 feet tall, and when it came through the door, the horns rising from its helmet tore a set of ragged slashes into the upper jamb. They looked like quotation marks.
"Run!"
a yammering voice in his mind screamed.
"Run, you thief!" the hotel whispered.
"No," Jack answered. He stared up at the advancing knight, and his hand wrapped itself tightly around the guitar pick in his pocket. The spike-studded gauntlets came up toward the visor of its bird helmet. They raised it. Jack gaped. The inside of the helmet was empty. Then those studded hands were reaching for Jack. The spike-studded hands came up and grasped either side of the cylindrical helmet. They lifted it slowly off, disclosing the livid, haggard face of a man who looked at least 300 years old. One side of this ancient's head had been bashed in. Splinters of bone like broken eggshell poked out through the skin, and the wound was caked with some black goop, which Jason supposed was decayed brains. It was not breathing, but the red-rimmed eyes which regarded Jason were sparkling and hellishly avid. It grinned, and Jason saw the needle-sharp teeth with which this horror would rip him to pieces. It clanked unsteadily forward. But that wasn't the only sound. He looked to his left, toward the main hall lobby of the castle hotel, and saw a second knight, this one wearing the shallow, bowl-shaped headguard known as the Great Helm. Behind it were a third and a fourth. They came slowly down the corridor, moving suits of ancient armor, which now housed vampires of some sort. Then the hands seized him by the shoulders. The blunt spikes on the gloves slid into his shoulders and arms. Warm blood flowed, and the livid, wrinkled face drew into a horrid, hungry grin. The cubitiere at the elbow screeched and wailed as the dead knight drew the boy toward itself. Jack howled with the pain. The short, blunt-tipped spikes on its hands were in him, and he understood once and for all that this was real, and in another moment this thing was going to kill him. He was yanked toward the yawning, empty blackness inside that helmet. But was it really empty? Jack caught a blurred, faded impression of a double red glow in the darkness, something like eyes. And as the armored hands drew him up and up, he felt freezing cold, as if all the winters that ever were had somehow combined, had somehow become one winter, and that river of frigid air was now pouring out of that empty helmet. "It's really going to kill me, and my mother will die. Richard will die. Sloat will win. Going to kill me, going to tear me apart, rip me open with its teeth. Freeze me solid. Jack!" Speedy's voice cried. "Jason!" Parkus's voice cried. "The pick, boy! Use the pick before it's too late! For Jason's sake, use the pick before it's too late!" Jack's hand closed around it. It was as hot as the coin had been. And the numbing cold was replaced with a sudden sense of brain-busting triumph. He brought it out of his pocket, crying out in pain as his punctured muscles flexed against the spikes driven into him, but not losing that sense of triumph, that lovely sensation of territory's heat, that clear feeling of rainbow. The pick, for it was a pick again, was in his fingers, a strong and heavy triangle of ivory, filigreed and inlaid with strange designs, and in that moment Jack and Jason saw those designs come together in a face, the face of Laura Deloessian, the face of Lily Cavanaugh Sawyer. "In her name, you filthy, aborted thing!" they shouted together. But it was one shout only, the shout of that single nature, Jack Jason. "Get you off the skin of this world! In the name of the Queen and in the name of her son, get you off the skin of this world!" Jason brought the guitar pick down into the white, scrawny face of the old vampire thing in the suit of armor. At the same instant he sideslipped without blinking into Jack, and saw the pick whistle down into a freezing black emptiness. There was another moment as Jason, when he saw the vampire thing's red eyes bulge outward in disbelief as the tip of the pick plunged into the center of its deeply wrinkled forehead. A moment later, the eyes themselves, already filming over, exploded, and a black, steaming ichor ran over his hand and wrist. It was full of tiny, biting worms. Jack was flung against the wall. He hit his head. In spite of that, and of the deep, throbbing pain in his shoulders and upper arms, he held on to the pick. The suit of armor was rattling like a scarecrow made out of tin cans. Jack had time to see it was swelling somehow, and he threw a hand up to shield his eyes. The suit of armor self-destructed. It did not spray shrapnel everywhere, but simply fell apart. Jack thought if he had seen it in a movie instead of as he saw it now, huddled in a lower hallway of this stinking hotel with blood trickling into his armpits, he would have laughed. The polished steel helmet, so like the face of a bird, fell onto the floor with a muffled thump. The curved gorget, meaning to keep the knight's enemy from running a blade or a spear point through the knight's throat, fell directly inside it with a jingle of tightly meshed rings of mail. The cuirasses fell like curved steel bookends. The greaves split apart. Metal rained down on the moldy carpet for 2 seconds, and then there was only a pile of something that looked like scrap heap leftovers. Jack pushed himself up the wall, staring with wide eyes, as if he expected the suit of armor to suddenly fly back together. In fact, he really did expect something like that. But when nothing happened, he turned left toward the lobby and saw three more suits of armor moving slowly toward him. One held a cheesy, mold-caked banner, and on it was a symbol Jack recognized. He had seen it fluttering from guidance held by Morgan of Orus's soldiers as they escorted Morgan's black diligence down the outpost road and toward Queen Laura's pavilion. Morgan's sign. But these were not Morgan's creatures, he understood dimly. They carried his banner as a kind of morbid joke on this frightened interloper who presumed to steal away their only reason for being.
"No more," Jack whispered hoarsely. The pick trembled between his fingers. Something had happened to it.
It had been damaged somehow when he used it to destroy the suit of armor which had come from the Heron Bar. The ivory, formerly the color of fresh cream, had yellowed noticeably. Fine cracks now crisscrossed it. The suits of armor clanked steadily toward him. One slowly drew a long sword, which ended in a cruel-looking double point.
"No more," Jack moaned. "Oh, God, please, no more. I'm tired. I can't. Please, no more, no more. Traveling Jack, old traveling Jack. Speedy, I can't," he screamed.
Tears cut through the dirt on his face. The suits of armor approached with all the inevitability of steel auto parts on an assembly line. He heard an arctic wind whistling inside their cold black spaces.
"You be here in California to bring her back. Please, Speedy, no more."
Reaching for him, black metal robot faces, rusty greaves, mails splotched and smeared with moss and mold.
"Got to do your best, traveling Jack,"
Speedy whispered, exhausted. And then he was gone, and Jack was left to stand or fall on his own. Chapter 42. Jack and the Talisman. "You made a mistake," a ghostly voice in Jack Sawyer's head spoke up, as he stood outside the Heron Bar and watched these other suits of armor bear down on him. In his mind, an eye opened wide, and he saw an angry man, a man who was really not much more than an overgrown boy, striding up a western street toward the camera, buckling on first one gun belt and then another so that they crisscrossed his belly. "You made a mistake. You should have killed both of the Ellis brothers." Of all his mother's movies, the one Jack had always liked the best was Last Train to Hangtown, made in 1960 and released in 1961. It had been a Warner Brothers picture, and the major parts, as in many of the lower-budget pictures Warner's made during that period, were filled by actors from the half-dozen Warner Brothers TV series, which were in constant production. Jack Kelly from The Maverick Show had been in Last Train, the suave gambler, and Andrew Duggan from Bourbon Street Beat, the evil cattle baron. Clint Walker, who played a character called Cheyenne Bodie on TV, starred as Rafe Ellis, the retired sheriff who must strap on his guns one last time. Inger Stevens had been originally slated to play the part of the dance hall girl with willing arms and a heart of gold, but Miss Stevens had come down with a bad case of bronchitis, and Lily Cavanaugh had stepped into the part. It was of a sort she could have done competently in a coma. Once, when his parents thought he was asleep and were talking in the living room downstairs, Jack overheard his mother say something striking as he padded barefoot to the bathroom to get a glass of water. It was striking enough, at any rate, so that Jack never forgot it. "All the women I played knew how to fuck, but not one of them knew how to fart," she told Phil. Will Hutchins, who starred in another Warner Brothers program, this one was called Sugarfoot, had also been in the film. Last Train to Hangtown was Jack's favorite chiefly because of the character Hutchins played. It was this character, Andy Ellis by name, who came to his tired, tottering, overtaxed mind now as he watched the suits of armor marching down the dark hallway toward him. Andy Ellis had been the cowardly kid brother who gets mad in the last reel.
After skulking and cowering through the entire movie, he had gone out to face Duggan's evil minions after the chief minion, played by sinister, stubbly, wall-eyed Jack Elam, who played chief minions in all sorts of Warner epics, both theatrical and televisional, had shot his brother Rafe in the back. Hutchins had gone striding down the dusty, widescreen street, strapping on his brother's gun belts with clumsy fingers, shouting, "Come on! Come on! I'm ready for you! You made a mistake! You should have killed both of the Ellis brothers!" Will Hutchins had not been one of the greatest actors of all time, but in that moment he had achieved, at least in Jack's eyes, a moment of clear truth and real brilliance. There was a sense that the kid was going to his death and knew it, but meant to go on anyway. And although he was frightened, he was not striding up the street toward the showdown with the slightest reluctance. He went eagerly, sure of what he meant to do, even though he had to fumble again and again with the buckles of the gun belts. The suits of armor came on, closing the distance, rocking from side to side like toy robots. They should have keys sticking out of their backs, Jack thought. He turned to face them, the yellowed pick held between the thumb and forefinger of his right hand as if to strum a tune. They seemed to hesitate, as if sensing his fearlessness. The hotel itself seemed to suddenly hesitate, or to open its eyes to a danger that was deeper than it had at first thought. Floors groaned their boards, somewhere a series of doors clapped shut one after the other, and on the roofs the brass ornaments ceased turning for a moment. Then the suits of armor clanked forward again. They now made a single moving wall of plate and chainmail, of greaves and helmets and sparkling gorgets. One held a spiked iron ball on a wooden haft, one a martel de fer, the one in the center held the double-pointed sword. Jack suddenly began to walk toward them, his eyes lit up. He held the guitar pick out before him, his face filled with that radiant Jason glow. He sideslipped momentarily into the territories and became Jason. Here the shark's tooth, which had been a pick, seemed to be a flame. As he approached the three knights, one pulled off its helmet, revealing another of those old, pale faces. This one was thick with jowls, and the neck hung with waxy wattles that looked like melting candle wax. It heaved its helmet at him. Jason dodged it easily and slipped back into his Jack self as a helmet crashed off a paneled wall behind him. Standing in front of him was a headless suit of armor. "You think that scares me?" he thought contemptuously. "I've seen that trick before. It doesn't scare me. You don't scare me. And I'm going to get it. That's all." This time he did not just feel the hotel listening. This time it seemed to recoil all around him, as the tissue of a digestive organ might recoil from a poisoned bit of flesh. Upstairs, in the five rooms where the five guardian knights had died, five windows blew out like gunshots. Jack bore down on the suits of armor. The talisman sang out from somewhere above in its clear and sweetly triumphant voice. "Jason, to me!" "Come on!" Jack shouted at the suits of armor and began to laugh. He couldn't help himself. Never had laughter seemed so strong to him, so potent, so good as this. It was like water from a spring or from some deep river. "Come on! I'm ready for you! I don't know what fucked-up round table you guys came from, but you should have stayed there. You made a mistake!" Laughing harder than ever, but as grimly determined inside as Wotan on the Valkyrie's rock, Jack leaped at the headless, swaying figure in the center. "You should have killed both of the Ellis brothers!" he shouted, and as Speedy's guitar pick passed into the zone of freezing air where the knight's head should have been, the suit of armor fell apart. In her bedroom at the Alhambra, Lily Cavanaugh Sawyer suddenly looked up from the book she had been reading. She thought she had heard someone—no, not just someone, Jack—call out from far down the deserted corridor, perhaps even from the lobby. She listened, eyes wide, lips pursed, heart hoping, but there was nothing. Jacko was still gone, the cancer was still eating her up a bite at a time,
and it was still an hour and a half before she could take another of the big brown horse pills that damped down the pain a little bit. She had begun to think more and more often of taking all the big brown horse pills at once. That would do more than damp the pain for a bit. That would finish it off forever. They say we can't cure cancer. But don't you believe that bullshit, Mr. C? Try eating about 2 dozen of these. What do you say? Want to go for it? What kept her from doing it was Jack. She wanted so badly to see him again that now she was imagining his voice, not just doing a simple, albeit corny sort of thing like calling her name either, but quoting from one of her old pictures. "You are one crazy old bitch, Lily," she croaked, and lit a Herbert Terry tune with thin, shaking fingers. She took 2 puffs and then put it out. Any more than 2 puffs started the coughing these days, and the coughing tore her apart. One crazy old bitch. She picked up her book again, but couldn't read because the tears were coursing down her face, and her guts hurt. They hurt. Oh, they hurt. And she wanted to take all the brown pills, but she wanted to see him again first. Her dear son with his clear, handsome forehead and his shining eyes. "Come home, Jacko," she thought. "Please come home soon, or the next time I talk to you it'll be by Ouija board. Please, Jack, please come home." She closed her eyes and tried to sleep. The night which had held the spike ball swayed a moment longer, displaying its vacant middle, and then it also exploded. The one remaining raised its battle hammer and then simply fell apart in a heap. Jack stood amid the wreckage for a moment, still laughing, and then stopped as he looked at Speedy's pick. It was a deep and ancient yellow now. The cracked glaze had become a snarl of fissures. "Never mind, Traveling Jack. You get on. I think there may be one more of those walking Maxwell House cans around some place. If so, you'll take it on, won't you?"
"If I have to, I will," Jack muttered aloud.
Jack kicked aside a greave, a helmet, a breastplate. He strode down the middle of the hall, the carpet squelching under his sneakers. He reached the lobby and looked around briefly. "Jack, come to me, Jason, come to me," the talisman sang. Jack started up the staircase. Halfway up, he looked at the landing and saw the last of the knights standing and looking down at him. It was a gigantic figure, better than 11 feet tall. Its armor and its plume were black, and a baleful red glare fell through the eye slit in its helmet. One mailed fist gripped a huge mace. For a moment, Jack stood frozen on the staircase, and then he began to climb again.